This is a Voyascape podcast. You can find all of our travel podcasts from around the world at voyascape.com.
This episode is sponsored by Smart Travel, a new podcast from NerdWallet. You know that one friend who always finds the best travel deals, picks the right cards, and somehow ends up in first class for the price of coach? Smart Travel is like that friend, but in podcast form. They cover all things travel finance, like when it makes sense to book flights with cash versus points. Upgrade trips, not bills, with NerdWallet. Follow Smart Travel wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Fromer Travel Show. I'm your host, Pauline Fromer, and we are celebrating today because for the first time in over a decade, we have a new Fromer's Japan book out. In the interim, we had done a book just on Western Honshu, which is the part of Japan that most visitors go to, Tokyo, Kyoto, and the like. But we realized that the entire nation deserved better coverage. And so we went on a big search to find the best author for that job. We found him. He is on the phone right now. His name is David McElhinney. Did I pronounce your name right?
Almost, but I wouldn't worry about everyone butchers it. It's McElhinney.
McElhinney.
Yeah.
I've mostly talked to you and said just David. So
yeah, most people do. Yeah. They say the name and they avoid it.
Right. And I think probably people can hear from your accent that you are not a Japanese native, that you come from Northern Ireland, correct?
Yes, yeah. If the name didn't give it away, I'm sure the accent will, yeah. From Belfast originally.
So how did you come to be what I consider one of the finest Japan experts I've ever encountered?
Thank you very much. That's making me blush. Well, it was sort of a spontaneous decision. I was traveling a lot in Southeast Asia. Really liked that part of the world. I lived in China for 6 months as a teacher. I'm using inverted commas there because I didn't do an awful lot of teaching, but that was my official role. And then I lived in Australia for a year, which was fine, but I was just kind of doing odd jobs on like building sites, worked in call centers, things like that. But I kind of felt drawn back to Asia, and I'd never been to Japan, but it was always somewhere culturally that kind of fascinated me. So I decided I would move there for a year in principle to teach English, and that turned into two, which turned into three, and so on. I just kind of fell in love with the place as I thought I might. So yeah, that's the very contracted version.
Yeah, and it's been 7 years now that you've been, you know, in and around Japan.
7 years, yeah.
7 years, yeah. And writing about it extensively. And as a writer, I don't think this will come as a surprise to anybody. You do not have funding that is unlimited. Right?
No. And
Japan can be a very, very expensive country. Well, it's less expensive now because the Japanese yen is much weaker against many world currencies, including the US dollar. But still, it is an overall expensive place. So what are some of the ways that you, in the book and in your daily life, talking with pals, tell people they can save money in Japan?
Yeah, I think you kind of touched on it there. It's like expensive is a relative term. I mean, Japan certainly was more expensive than it is now, but I think people always want to try and save money where they can. And there are certain things in the country which are still quite pricey. Like, I would say the number one biggest expense, well, the two biggest expenses are accommodation and transport. It's perhaps not unique to Japan, but with transport specifically, what's expensive are the bullet trains, which people will obviously use to get around the country because it's more convenient than flying. It is more expensive than flying, but it's more convenient. And I think people see the bullet train as like a travel experience in and of itself, you know? So,
well, I felt that way when I did it. I mean, there is that moment where it just zooms out of the station. I've always heard about the Concorde when that was flying, and there was this moment where you were pressed back into your seat and then you suddenly rocketed forward. And the bullet train almost felt like that. I mean, the speed was I could feel it.
Yeah, now that you mention it, you do get that sensation the first time you take the bullet train, but it's weird, you know, like anything, when you start to do it quite regularly, you sort of forget about that. Yeah, it's an experience in and of itself. So people will almost certainly use the bullet train as their primary method for getting around the country. A good way to save money on that is through the JR Pass, the Japan Rail Pass, which you have to get before you come to the country. It basically gives you like a one-use ticket that you can, or a one all-encompassing ticket that you can use on all of the different bullet trains that you'll use and local trains, provided they're operated by Japan Rail. Now, it gets a little bit confusing in the cities because sometimes there a train might be run by a private operator, or, you know, might be a metro line, which I think is sort of run by the city. But in general, it means that you have one ticket that you can use on the majority of trains that you're going to get in the country. Rather than like kind of going into the specifics of pricing, yeah, I would say the best way to think about it is like you can go online to the Japan Rail Pass fare calculator, kind of tot up the journeys you think you're probably going to do, see how much that's going to cost, and then just cross-reference that with the price of the 7, 14, or 21-day ticket. Sometimes, yeah, you know, the 7-day ticket might be a little bit more expensive than the amount of trains you want to get in a 7-day period. But you also might say, well, it's only a 2,000-3,000 yen difference, and that's negligible given that I don't have to go through the stress of getting a ticket for each train I'm getting on. I mean, people who are thinking about going to Japan might have read that there was a big price hike in the JR Pass recently. It was a 69% price hike, which is, is pretty, it is pretty yikes. But to put that into perspective, it was the first time they had increased the price since like the 80s or something. So, and I think it was also kind of in line with the fact that the yen had already weakened by that stage and they were trying to capitalize on tourists' increased purchasing power. So I would say from a tourist perspective, I still think it's like a good value pass, but you can obviously arbitrate on that yourself depending on where you plan on going.
Right. And it's a price we should note that the Japanese themselves do not have access to. This pass is only for tourists, which, you know, is an interesting thing. Usually there's something that we think of as the tourist tax, where tourists are charged more. This has always been a very generous program, I thought, on behalf of the railroad.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I've always, I mean, recently, actually, I lost my visa for the first time. So the next time I go back to Japan, I will be there as a tourist. But it means that I've never had access to this pass myself. And I've always been jealous when people come to visit and they're doing these, you know, kind of wild, you know, trips all around the country. And any time I join them, I have to, pay the standard fare. So, yeah, it is. It's great. I mean, there are, I would say tourists are taxed in other ways, but when it comes to riding the bullet train, yeah, they certainly get a good deal.
Well, before I let you go on that, how are tourists taxed in other ways, would you say?
There's been quite a lot in the news over the past couple of years about over-tourism in Japan. And I guess what one good example to use is Himeji Castle, which is probably the most beautiful castle in Japan. It's largely viewed as that. Like, it's really stunning. It's in this city that's between Kobe and Hiroshima. A lot of people go to Himeji just to see the castle, you know. I think it was the city mayor, I'm trying to remember now, but someone from officialdom was basically trying to make tourists pay five times the amount that locals would pay.
Wow.
Which, in some respects, it's like, well, that seems like a huge hike. But at the same time, if the purpose of it is to only entice people who really want to go and see the castle, rather than people who are walking past going, I'll go in because it's only whatever, 500,000 yen to see it. I think it was used in that way, and therefore it does manage the crowds a little bit. Don't have much of a problem with it. But at the same time, you know, there is the moral aspect of, well, if we start levying that everywhere and tourists have to pay crazy money for everything, you know, that's its own issue. But that's just one example. And I think some restaurants were floating. In fact, I think some restaurants actually did implement that. But
different prices on the English language menu, or how did it work?
Well, some of them were caught sneakily doing that, unfortunately. But I think there were some restaurants in smaller towns and stuff that basically said locals will only pay this price and non-locals will pay a bit more. It certainly hasn't, you know, caught fire and spread all around the country, but there are little stories like that. And as there is some growing kind of unrest in certain corners of the country about the amount of foreigners coming in on a yearly basis and the numbers increasing each year, then stories like that will be in the news, but I don't expect that to be implemented on a broad scale anytime soon.
Interesting. All right, we'll go back to saving money. So you save money by getting the bullet train pass or the train pass, which covers a lot of different trains. You also need to save money on accommodations, but there are hotels or hotel types that don't exist other places, like capsule hotels. Do you recommend those for visitors? And can you give a definition of what those are? Or is that really just for Japanese businessmen?
Well, that's how they started. They were kind of advertised as these, kind of stopover places for Japanese businessmen. Like if you go to some of the old ones, they still have like corded telephones and, you know, stuff that a businessman might need, you know, when he's overnighting. They're still used by younger tourists, I would say. I don't mind them on occasion as like maybe to like show someone. Like I see it as more of a novelty thing. Like I personally, I wouldn't book one myself typically if I was going somewhere, but
we should define what these are before we go
sure.
on further. Can you give a description?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the best visual aid I can give is like, you know, imagine like a morgue was a hotel. It's got these kind of like lines. Rather than pull out drawers, they're just sort of like little kind of cubby holes that you enter into, and you have the entire space is just a bed with maybe like a side shelf. No, you can't stand up. Maybe there's like a side shelf and there'll be a charging station or whatever. And down the hall somewhere will be the locker area where you can put your bag and all that kind of stuff. So
is it curtained off or is there more of a solid door to your cubby?
It depends. A lot of them would have kind of like, you know, pull down blinds, which you sort of hook at the bottom. I mean, they're private in a sense. It's sort of like a hostel room, but a bit more private. That also means it has the attendant noise that you get in a hostel room, but times by perhaps, you know, a factor of 10, because maybe there's 40 people sleeping in the area. So you hear every, you know, snore and fart and burp and, you know, rustling pillow and all the rest of it. But yeah, I mean, I guess it's kind of like an interesting thing to maybe stay in. They're cheap, like certainly cheaper than most other accommodation options. If you've got one night in a place, like I think, you know, and you want to check it out, why not give it a go? You know, what's the worst that could happen kind of thing if you are claustrophobic or you really like, you know, home comforts and things like that. Maybe give them a miss. Another thing actually is a lot of them have like, they're basically designed for one night stays so that if you're between the usual checkout and check-in time, you would have to take all of your stuff out of it and back in again. Which is super inconvenient. That kind of defeats the purpose of staying in a hotel to begin with, right?
So,
yeah. I mean, I see them more as like kind of, you know, curiosities than something I'd like to stay in with any regularity, but, you know, to each their own.
Yeah. And one of the things that surprisingly isn't expensive in Japan, I've found when I've been there a couple of times, is food. You can get very decent food in convenience stores. You can get a wonderful meal for less than the equivalent of $10 at a noodle place. That, to me, is not one of the major expenses. Were you going to give another tip for saving money? Did I cut you off with the capsule hotels?
No, I mean, I guess just to finish off on the accommodation point, it's like a very sort of brief point, but there are some really nice chain hotels you can stay in. Like one of the most famous ones is APA or APA, another one called My Stays. And they're like just basic, you know, chain hotels, but done well. You know, I would say they're pretty comfortable. The amenities are quite good. And it's often a good way to cut costs rather than staying in maybe a nice kind of boutique accommodation or something that's a bit fancier in one of the more popular areas. But yeah, on food, yeah, I mean, I completely agree. I think Japanese food is, for me, it's probably the greatest food culture on earth. There are certainly a couple that could give it a run for its money. And I'm probably biased given the amount of time I've spent there. But part of what impressed me about it is the, you know, when I moved there, I thought it was like sushi and ramen. I didn't really know. That was kind of like the extent of my Japanese culinary knowledge. But there's amazing depth and complexity. And like every region will have a meibutsu, which is sort of like a regional speciality. Usually it's some kind of food. It might just be like noodles made a certain way, or a certain type of, you know, pounded rice cake, or maybe it's like a certain fish, or, you know, beef that they do a certain way. Often they'll have multiple, you know, specialities. So that aspect of it is really cool, as is the fact that you can get good food at every price range. So like you said, you can go to, you know, some of the best ramen shops you'll ever eat in your life, and you're paying $10 maybe, the current exchange, probably less, for a bowl of ramen. That's a big hearty plate of food, you know, that's been simmering for 14 hours or something like that. You know, it's like, it's incredible really what you can get for very little money. Then of course you've got the super expensive sushi restaurants, you've got, you know, Tokyo,
there's like meals, very
all that kind of stuff. And in Tokyo alone, you know, there's like 300 plus Michelin stars across however many restaurants. Might even be more than that. Might even be 500 across 300 restaurants. I can't remember exactly, but it's a lot. It's the most in the world anyway. So you've got a lot of stuff at that end of the spectrum. And like you mentioned, even the convenience store foods, like in the UK, and from my experience in America, you know, if you went to a 7-Eleven or something like that, if they have a hot food counter, the food's usually pretty bad.
Oh, that's terrible.
Being charitable. Terrible.
Get you sick bad.
Whereas in Japan, that food is, obviously it's very cheap, you know, because of the type of food that it is. But like the hot chicken, it's actually really good.
Yeah.
The sandwiches are nice. They might be filled with MSG, but, you know, you're never going to get the healthiest food in a convenience store to begin with. But like, they're famous to the point that there's loads of YouTube vlogs and stuff that cover the kind of subculture of Japanese convenience store food. So if you're interested, it's worth going to check some of them out. You know, it's like they do fruit sandwiches and all these, you know, strange flavors of Kit Kats and things like that. And a great, and they're all open 24/7, so a great place to stop late at night, you know, if you need a bite to eat before you go to bed or whatever.
Now, in terms of regional specialties, going back to that briefly, is there a region you think that has the best food in Japan or the most interesting?
Wow. Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, the boring answer is probably Tokyo, just because it's got, I think, the most innovation in food. Like, Japan is quite steadfastly against change when it comes to cultural traditions, whereas if you look at like the ramen space in Tokyo, there's lots of really innovative things going on. Lots of the kind of best modern fine dining restaurants there are not these sort of super serious, you know, have no fun, eat the food, bow, say thank you, and then get the hell out of here type places, which used to be like the entire kind of upper end of the dining market in Japan. In Tokyo, there's a lot more kind of like very homely places that are still serving food that's like 1-2 Michelin star quality, you know? So that's the kind of boring answer. I'm trying to think of, you know, something that's maybe a bit more interesting. Kyotango is a cool area. It's part of Kyoto Prefecture, but if you go to the kind of the coastal area, it's often just called Kyoto by the Sea, actually. And they produce a lot of foods there with koji, which is the fungal mold that's used in like sake production and stuff. And it has, I think, more than 100 enzymes that facilitate digestion. So there's lots of really good like miso, soy sauce, rice wine vinegar. They produce a lot of that stuff there, and then obviously they serve it with the different rice noodle, you know, dishes, etc., fish that they make in the region. But that fungal mold koji is supposedly really beneficial to longevity. So Okinawa is usually the most famous place for centenarians or people that live beyond 100 in Japan. But there was a study in 2019, albeit I think with a smaller sample size, that found that in Kyotango they have almost 3 times as many centenarians as the national average. And the oldest guy that ever lived actually lived there as well. He was 116 when he died.
He
lived through 3 centuries. Yeah, born in 1897, died in 2013. Kind of amazing, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, a lot of the locals, if you speak to like, you know, local producers and stuff down there, like food producers, they'll always credit koji as like the kind of the elixir of, you know, long life or whatever. And just as an aside, if anyone wants to visit that region, there's a woman called Junko Hamilton, who's Japanese, grew up in the Kyoto area, but she lived in Ireland for 10 years. And she runs cooking classes and can kind of explain all this stuff to you in fluent English. And yeah, you'll get to cook foods with koji and try different koji-made products. The restaurant, what's it called? Table is the name of the restaurant, but I think it's T-A-B-L-E-T-A-B-E-L, or that's the other way around. I can't remember. But it's okay. In the book. If you buy the book, yeah. You'll find it. Yeah.
Get the book. Get the book. That's what we're here to say. Now, you were talking a moment ago about YouTubers doing convenience store food videos, which brings us to the pop culture side of Japan. You have a beautiful phrase in the book. You say it's their soft power.
Yeah.
Basically, that the whole world has been taken over by anime and manga and other Japanese incredibly creative ways of seeing the world. It used to be that people went to Japan strictly to visit temples and have kaiseki meals and indulge in traditional Japanese culture. But now a lot of people go there to see what's happening on the cutting edge, what's happening in youth culture, what's happening in these new artistic expressions. So if people are interested in that side of Japan, where do they go? What do they do?
Yeah, it's an interesting trend, isn't it? I mean, I'm kind of that generation. You know, I'm 31, so I'm that generation that grew up playing Pokemon, you know, getting Pokemon cards and Yu-Gi-Oh, all that kind of stuff. So I was certainly influenced by that stuff myself. So I do get the incentive to travel to Japan to kind of see that side of it. Like a lot of things, Tokyo is sort of the beating heart of that, particularly an area called Akihabara, which to anyone who has done any research about like pop culture Japan will have come across that place. It's the Mecca, you know, and it's just a cool area in general. You know, it's like a big thoroughfare, just neon lights, you know, on either side and filled with arcades and retro game stores, all that kind of stuff. Another area of Tokyo that's quite famous, particularly for women, is called Otome Road, which literally means Maiden Road. And it's in Ikebukuro, which is sort of northwest-ish of the city. And it's particularly famous for doujinshi, which are like basically fanzines. So the sort of thing that if it was in America or the UK, these things would fall foul of every copyright law in the legislature. You know, like they're completely illegal, but loads of doujinshi artists are really talented. So the industry just kind of lets it pass. And then sometimes they co-opt those artists.
Before we go further, fanzines. So these are magazines made by fans in the style of more famous artists. Is that the way to put it?
Yeah, I think so. I guess that's how I would put it. Yeah. And often you might get, for example, a character from one famous series and a character for another famous series. And the fanzine will be those two characters in some kind of romantic relationship or whatever.
I see. So this is the area where they're produced, but why would a visitor go there? Would they experience any of this culture there?
So this is the area where the shops are that sell those.
Oh, yeah. I see.
Yeah, so it's famous for that actually, and also for cosplay. So, you know, lots of women especially, again, would go and buy costumes of their favorite anime and manga heroines. And then in that same area in Ikebukuro, there's a Halloween cosplay festival. So if you're there that time of year and you're into cosplay, that's the place to go to both get your gear and to flaunt it on the street, I guess.
Wow. So thousands of people in crazy costumes all over the place.
Yeah.
Very that's Japanese.
Yeah, it is. You know, it's like there's obviously huge sell. I mean, even the word cosplay, like we kind of think of it as like an English word, but it was actually a Japanese portmanteau of two English words, like cosplay, you know, cosplay.
Oh.
Yeah, which I only discovered that not that long ago. And I was
what does cos mean, though? I'm not sure.
So they've taken the English words costume and play and just squeezed them together into their own words, yeah.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. I just thought it meant like duo play, like co-play. But no, it's costume play.
That's an interesting way to think of it. Etymologically, actually, yeah. I guess I just hadn't questioned it. It's like, you know, when you hear and see a word enough, it just is that word. It was only probably about a year or so ago myself that I realized it was of Japanese origin, Japanese English origin, if that makes sense.
Yeah, very interesting. And I have a dear friend, Mike Foster, who is a professor of Japanese mythology. And he's written a whole bunch of books on the fact that we are seeing mythology being created in real time in Japan. You know, we think of mythology as being something that maybe was part of religion eons ago and is something in the past. And in Japan, he feels that what's going on with this very intense culture around what we'd call cartoons is actually a rejiggering of the mythological hierarchies of the Japanese mind.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, a lot of these places, you know, in the same vein, they do feel like temples to Japanese pop culture, to different series. I mean, a good example, actually, to throw in another one is Kyoto, or just outside Kyoto, they recently opened the Nintendo Museum. It's just the first sort of museum of its kind. And it really does feel like almost like a religious, you know, ode to this very storied Japanese video game maker, console developer. And it's a really cool experience. That getting a ticket for it is a nightmare. You've got to go through this sort of convoluted lottery system and then call a Japanese number. And then you get your ticket sent by QR code.
A
couple of days before, it's a pain. But the one advantage of that is that they have very controlled numbers that can be in the museum at any one time, which obviously benefits the user experience. And also in the main top floor, which is kind of all the archives of all the old games and peripherals and box arts and instruction manuals, all that kind of stuff, you can't take any photos in there, which I think is great, because otherwise it would just be selfie sticks everywhere and influencers blocking all of the displays and all that kind of stuff. That's not to besmirch influencers, but you know, I've experienced that enough times in places like that I think that's what would have happened. That's what would have happened. So
before you go on from that, so it sounds like a really difficult process. Is it all in Japanese, or can Americans, can non-Japanese speakers go to this museum?
Yeah, it's in English. I think it's kind of created as the experience for, you know, the wider tourism market, I would say, as a lot of modern museums and things are built with that in mind. So yeah, very, very approachable for English speakers. And as is the ticketing system is all in English as well. It's convoluted more from like a design perspective rather than a language perspective. For anyone listening who's got any affiliation for Nintendo, I do recommend going, because it's a cool experience.
Cool. Okay. Now, at the very beginning of our talk, you brought up the fact that Japan is getting over-touristed, that there are certain areas that are just too damn crowded to be as enjoyable as they used to be. And I know you took it very seriously, wanting as a guidebook writer to show that other parts of the country that people don't think of going to are as intriguing, as rewarding to go to. So let's talk about some of the places that people don't think of going to, but really should.
Sure. Yeah. I think you've got to strike that balance, don't you? You know, if lots of people, especially if they're going to Japan for the first time, they're going to want to go to Tokyo, Kyoto, probably Osaka, maybe Hiroshima, maybe Hakone, something like that. So you've absolutely got to cater to that. But I think also there's some responsibility to kind of show people that Japan is actually a much bigger country than that golden route, as it's known. And furthermore, lots of the places, especially smaller places in Japan, are suffering from depopulation and economic malaise and all that kind of stuff. So if you go and visit some of the smaller towns around the country, every dollar or yen you spend there actually has a bit of an impact. So from an ethical standpoint as well, I think it's good to try and vary things a little bit when you travel. But I mean, it's up to the traveler in question. My job is not to tell anybody what to do. You know,
sure. From an ethical standpoint, and would it also be fair to say, from a welcoming standpoint, are they excited to see tourists in a way that maybe folks in Kyoto and Tokyo won't be?
Yeah, for sure. Just to take an example, Niodo in the center of Kochi Prefecture on Shikoku Island, they kind of do need you. You know, like every penny you spend there is like actually beneficial to the town in a way that, you know, tour buses coming into certain places and just, you know, buying food from a convenience store and drinks from a vending machine. And the money kind of doesn't really go to any like independent people living in certain areas, if that's kind of the method by which you travel. And to come back to that place in the Odo, just to give a bit more
tell
context
us about it.
As to what it's like. So it's right up in the heart of Kochi Prefecture in the mountains. It's this sort of thundering gorge, and on this little precipice in the gorge, there's a guy called Ken Mukai. He's got a Japanese name, but he's actually from California. I'm not sure what his ancestry is, but he grew up in California. He taught as a science teacher in the public school system there, and then decided to move to one of the most rural places you could find in Japan to brew beer. So he's got this little tiny microbrewery and tap room, literally perched right over this gorge. And the water in the gorge itself is called Nyodo Blue, which is, it's kind of like known as that because it's got this like very clear and very clean water. Like the artesian springs, I think, are like neutral. So basically gives him a canvas to create any beer he wants from it. When I visited him, he was telling me they have like a residence magazine they get sent out. And since he moved there, which was like 2020 or something, not an auspicious time to move anywhere and start a new business. Yeah. But since he's moved there, the number of residents per kilometer squared has dropped by like 4, I think, from like 17 to 13, something like that. Cause they get these figures in the residence magazine I mentioned. And he's named one of his beers 18, the number 18, because he's trying to get the population per square kilometer back up to that number. So yeah, going somewhere like that, you know, visiting these places, speaking to these people. There's an inn just across the bridge, which is at a former elementary school run by the former students. And you kind of get a sense that like, oh yeah, me being a tourist here is actually having a positive impact rather than
a negative one. Sure.
Yeah, or just kind of a scourge.
You go there for the brewery, you go there to see the incredible gorge. But I mean, maybe I'm a selfish person. I think that most people won't travel just to be good. You know, it's their time off. So why else do you go there? What are the other attractions? What do you see there and do there that you won't find elsewhere?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. A lot of people would sort of raise their eyebrows at that, I guess. I mean, first of all, it's a stunning area to drive through. So if you're able to rent a car, granted, not everyone is, but if you're able to rent a car, it's really nice driving through that area. There's lots of like canyoning activities, rafting, lots of outdoor stuff. You can hike around there. There are onsen hot springs, so you can go and, you know, relax in an outdoor hot spring. So it's more of an outdoors person's kind of a destination. But if that appeals to you, or if you feel like I'm traveling quite a lot in the cities, I wouldn't mind taking like 4 days to just go and get completely off grid. I'd recommend somewhere like that. And as I said, that's just one of the examples. There are other slightly closer to civilization examples of places where your tourism dollars can have more of a positive impact, I would say, on the local communities.
I know also, you know, the Camino de Santiago in Spain has become very, very popular. It's a walking pilgrimage, basically. I've heard there's a temple-to-temple pilgrimage in Japan now that a lot of people are doing. Do you know about that?
Yeah, well, it's interesting you mentioned the Camino, because it actually has a sister trail in Japan of Wakayama, which is not the one you're referring to, but I'll come to that in a second. So the one in Wakayama is, I guess the kind of brief version of the story is that it tells the tale of Japan's first emperor who got lost in these mountains, and then a three-legged crow lands on a branch. He follows the crow through these mountains and then attacks his enemy with the rising sun at his back, wins and founds Japan, basically is what happens. So his former route essentially is charted by the sister trail, which is called the Kumano Kodo, which is in Wakayama, quite close to Osaka. That's actually like a cool one to do, which doesn't require too much travel away from kind of the main tourism route. And the one you're referring to is the Shikoku pilgrimage, which...
But before we leave this one,
sure.
You mentioned the rising sun. Was this the inspiration for the flag?
Yeah, basically. So the rising sun is a sun goddess called Amaterasu, who's one of the main deities in Shinto mythology, Shinto being the sort of predominant national religion there.
Ah, okay. All right. Sorry to interrupt you.
No.
So you were talking about the other route.
Yeah, the Shikoku pilgrimage. So that basically follows the idea. It's kind of a loose idea, but the idea is that Shikoku Island is a mandala, so like a Buddhist diagram of eternal spiritual truths or something like that. And there's 88 temples that kind of go around the island, sort of in a circle, a little bit into the middle, and then back out around to where they started. And they're in honor of a monk known as Kukai or Kobo Daishi. And he didn't actually establish or build all of those temples. I think he maybe established some of them, and then this root sort of formed in honor to him. So lots of people do that, not necessarily because they have any affiliation to, I think it's Shingon Buddhism, which is quite an esoteric sect of the religion, but just because it's kind of a cool thing to do, you know, it's a good way to disconnect. It takes about 6 to 8 weeks, which granted is longer than the average traveler is going to have in Japan, right? But you, like the Camino, I guess, you know, you can come and do a week here, 2 weeks there, you know, split it up whatever way you want. Maybe you can just pick like, oh, here's 4 temples that are decent enough distance away from each other. Why don't I just follow that route? You know, there is a prescribed route you can follow, but you know, of course you can do it whichever way you please. Like there are lots of different access points in terms of airports and ferry ports and train stations and things like that. So you don't have to start at temple 1 or temple 88, if that makes sense.
And like the Camino, do you have people from all over the world doing this? So it's a very social activity?
Yeah, very much so. I've never actually walked it myself, but the last time I was in Shikoku, I made a point of driving to as much of it as I could, as I could fit in. And I would stop off at various temples and go and sort of accost people and try and ask them questions about why they were doing it. And yeah, you do. You get people from all over the place. Like, you know, I met an American guy who he'd worked in like tech for quite a few years and just decided that he wanted to kind of disconnect, I guess, from the world for a little while. So he was doing the full thing, had budgeted about 8 weeks for it. And he said, it's amazing, you know, you walk along the road, and because pilgrims often wear the same clothes, they wear conical straw hats and these white kind of garments and have a stick, that people will just stop and maybe give you some money, like just like a couple hundred yen to get a drink at the next vending machine or something, or maybe they'll give you some fresh produce from their farm. But he said that the generosity you see from strangers when you're a pilgrim on that trail is, yeah, kind of amazing. So that's a cool aspect of it. You know, Japanese people are known for being generous and friendly, and I think they really respect, on that island, they respect the tradition of the Shikoku pilgrimage, so they'll always help people out. And there are inns, you know, and campsites and things you can stay at. There are some rest stops I think you can stay in for free. There are temples that will also give free accommodation.
Interesting.
So
it's a whole ecosystem created for the pilgrimage.
Yeah, and it's still not super popular, but it's, I think, becoming popular enough that it's becoming more approachable for non-Japanese tourists to do.
Interesting. Well, as you can see, David is a wealth of information, and he poured it all into Fromer's Japan. We are so thrilled with the job you did, David. Thank you so, so much for doing this great book and also for appearing on the Fromer Travel Show.
No, it was great. Thank you very much. And, you know, I hope people buy it, of course, but I hope if they do that they find a lot of value in it. You know, it's writing a guidebook is difficult, but it's a labor of love, you know, in a lot of ways. You know, you got to enjoy doing it, but I think it's turned out well, so I hope people agree.
I know it has. Your editor Holly felt it's one of the best books we have in our series. So
oh, that's
many
great.
Congratulations.
Well, many thanks to Holly as well.
Yeah. All right, that's it for today's show. I thank you so much for listening. If you like the show, be sure to give us a nice 5-star rating. To those who are traveling, may I wish you a hearty bon voyage.
If you're a fan of travel stories, don't miss Go Nomad. I host this short form podcast to share inspiring interviews and unique perspectives from travelers all over the world, uncovering unforgettable and different adventures. Check it out at voyescape.com.